Chapter 34, Did Dinosaurs Get On and Off the Ark?
Who doesn't love picnics, you know what I'm saying? Finally, you're out of the city and into the wilderness.
No more traffic, no more industrial noise. Just the pleasant sounds of birds chirping and squirrels scampering. Ah, the fresh air.
The smell of smog has been replaced with the smell of pine cones. You throw down your checkered blanket and open your basket of goodies.
Now this is living, or is it?
At first you got a whiff of something like smoke, but you didn't plan on doing any barbecuing.
You just brought cold cuts.
While you're still trying to discover the source of the olfactory intrusion, you hear a small crackle off into the distance.
Was that a deer, a person? What was that? Soon the crackle turned into crackles as the smoke went from a mere whiff in your nose to a cloud in your face. It was everywhere.
You scramble to your feet and try to gather your belongings but are forced to leave them due to the heat. An unbelievable wave of suffocating heat instantly bore down upon you as you try your best to flee the scene. Looking behind you as you tear through the forest, you spy a deadly orange glow on the mountain ridge just behind you. You begin to run and cough and gag as you find yourself gasping for fresh air.
But you're not the only one.
Through the increasing volume of smoke, you see first one animal, then another, and still another running by you, also fleeing for their lives, more afraid of this threat than the threat of man.
Suddenly the sky and everything around you takes on an orange hue as burning embers began to land all over you, singeing your clothes, and then burning your skin. You quicken your pace as your gasping turns into an all-out choking.
The heat is unbearable, the sky is a scene from the Book of Revelation, as you head for the lake and jump in for your life.
But not everyone was as fortunate as you. When all was said and done, you spy there was indeed a barbecue that day. All the trees for miles around were blackened and scorched, the grass and wild flowers were no more, and bodies of baked forest animals lay all around, not able to make it out alive.
Of course, I'm talking about the fearful force of a wildfire.
Now folks, how many of you would like to have a picnic right smack dab in the middle of a wildfire? Yeah, even though it might save some time cooking our hot dogs, that's the last place we'd want to be, right? And hello. The reason is obvious. Wildfires are pretty scary, aren't they? Slightly. And yet, here's the irony. Most people today are totally fearful of going through a temporary wildfire, but they have absolutely no fear of going to an eternal hellfire. Why? Because there is no fear of God, before their eyes. And that means they're in a heap of trouble. Therefore, in order to help these arrogant people hopefully become more humble people, we're going to continue in our study, The Witness of Creation. And what we've been doing is taking a look at the five different evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing us that He's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with Him, the Creator of the universe, before it's too late. And so far we've seen the first evidence God left behind for us, showing us this amazing truth is the evidence of an intelligent creation. And then we saw the second evidence was the evidence of a young creation. And then we saw the third evidence was the evidence of a special creation. And then we saw the fourth evidence was the evidence of a judged creation. And then the last three times we saw the fifth evidence was the evidence of a fearful creation. And last time we saw, contrary to the lie of evolution, that a worldwide flood really did destroy the dinosaurs just like the Bible said. I'm sorry, I'll believe that any day of the week over what evolution teaches that they had a bad case of constipation or they turned into chickens. Hello. The Bible had it right all along. And we saw that by the evidences of dinosaur twisting, dinosaur tendering, and dinosaur tracking. It's almost like they were running away from something. Gee, I wonder what that was? But that's not all. Once again, God's very merciful to us. He just keeps answering our skeptical questions even when He doesn't have to. The fourth question concerning dinosaurs is, did dinosaurs get on and off the ark? You see, you might be thinking, okay, so it's quite obvious that God is the one who created the dinosaurs, along with all the other land animals. And it's obvious that dinosaurs coexisted with man. And it's even quite obvious that a worldwide flood is what caused dinosaurs to suddenly disappear. I get that. But I still have a problem. Does this mean that Noah took dinosaurs on the ark as well? And if so, how in the world did they get on and off? Well, hey, great question, I'm glad you asked. Let's ask God.
Genesis 6:19-20. You are to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. Two of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal and of every kind of creature that moves along the ground will come to you to be kept alive.
Now, folks, according to our text, you can clearly see that the Bible says that Noah was commanded by God to take two of every kind, not species, but two of every kind of air and land animal with him on the ark. And again, as was noted before in the previous study on a judged creation, notice that God was the one who would be bringing them to Noah. Noah didn't need to go around the world and somehow round them up. But more importantly to our current study, common sense tells us that since God said he'd bring to Noah two of every kind of land animal to load on the ark, then this must also include the dinosaur kind, because they too are land animals, right? Of course. And that naturally brings us to two questions concerning dinosaurs getting on the ark. The first question about dinosaurs getting on the ark is what about their size? I mean, last time I checked, dinosaurs are huge. Forget the giraffes and elephants. How in the world did Noah get the Apatosaurus or the Tyrannosaurus on board? Well, first of all, as one man pointed out, the big ones were big, but the little ones were little. Not all dinosaur kinds are as big as the Tyrannosaurus. In fact, as was mentioned before, the average size of the dinosaurs was that of a small horse or even a sheep. In fact, some were as small as chickens, and others were even smaller. So that obviously reduces the size problem. Secondly, even the big ones like the Tyrannosaurus or the Apatosaurus still didn't need to present a problem with their size. And that's because most likely, Noah being a smart guy, would only take babies or infants of the larger dinosaur kinds. In fact, he probably did this for all of the larger kinds of animals, including the giraffe and elephant. And the reasons are quite obvious. Babies take up less space, they're smaller and weigh less. They sleep more, eat less, and thus would require less care. And finally, babies would live longer and produce more of their own babies when they got off the ark, which is why they were being brought on board in the first place. So no, I don't see the size of the dinosaurs being a problem for them to get on the ark. But that brings us to the second question about dinosaurs getting on the ark, and that is what about the space? You see, the moment you say that dinosaurs got on the ark, people instantly not only gravitate towards a size problem, but they also visualize a space problem. They envision giant dinosaurs trying to stick their giant heads out the window and all hunched over, all squished in with other giant dinosaurs, while the ark is obviously sinking and cracking under the tremendous weight. But again, a quick look at the facts reveals that this assumption could be nothing further from the truth. First of all, as we just saw, size is not a problem if you think about it logically, and therefore secondly, as we saw in the previous study on a judged creation, space wasn't a problem either. Let's revisit a portion of that study. First of all, Noah didn't need to take along the water-breathing creatures. This would have seriously reduced the amount of space needed for the animals. Also, keep in mind that God said two of every kind of animal and not two of every species of animals. This too would immediately reduce the amount of space needed to hold all these animals. Noah didn't need two of each dog species, that would be a ton of dogs. He didn't need two of each dinosaur species, that would be a ton of dinosaurs. He only needed two of each kind, a male and a female, that's only two. In fact, some would say that there may have been fewer than 50 kinds of dinosaurs. However, I have to admit that two of every kind is still a lot of animals. And so that's the question. Could Noah's Ark contain even space to hold all these animals? Of course. Let's do the math. First of all, the ark was a barge, not a ship with sloping sides, so it had a larger carrying capacity. If you do the math, the ark would have been so huge that the total available floor space on the ark would have been over 100,000 square feet, which would be more floor space than in 20 standard-sized basketball courts. Assuming an 18-inch cubit, Noah's ark's total cubic volume would have been 1,518,000 cubic feet, that would be equal to the capacity of 569 modern railroad stock cars. Now that's a huge amount of space. But still, is it enough to hold two of every kind of air-breathing animal, including the dinosaurs? Of course. In fact, there would actually be a ton of room to spare, as these researchers discovered. Researchers discovered that on the high side, no more than 35,000 individual animals needed to go on the ark. Others would say, on the low side, that as few as 2,000 animals may have been required on the ark. But they decided to pad this number for error, and showed that the ark could easily accommodate 16,000 animals. But then they decided to be generous and pad this number even more to include extinct animals. Then they even added on some more just to satisfy even the most skeptical. They assumed an incredibly high number of 50,000 animals on the ark, far more animals than required, were on board the ark, and these need not have been the largest or even adult specimens. Since the average animal is about the size of a sheep and only a few animals are very large, such as the dinosaur or the elephant, which even these could be represented by much smaller younger ones, They used the railroad car for comparison and noted that the average double-deck stock car can accommodate 240 sheep. Thus, three trains hauling 69 cars each would have ample space to carry the 50,000 animals, filling only 37% of the ark. This would leave an additional 362 cars or enough to make five trains of 72.5 cars each to carry all of the food and baggage plus Noah's family of eight people. Also, keep in mind that these dimensions are based on the Hebrew cubit. If when Moses was writing the Genesis account he had in mind the larger Egyptian cubit, this would make this gargantuan boat even bigger. Either way, these findings clearly showed that the ark had plenty of space requirements. Now folks, I don't know about you, but once you look at it logically and even mathematically, it appears to me that the size or space requirements of dinosaurs present absolutely no problems whatsoever for them to be brought along the ark with all the other air-breathing land animals. How about you? It's almost like the Bible can be trusted from cover to cover. Gee, go figure. But you might be thinking, okay, so that makes perfect sense about how dinosaurs were in fact able to get on the ark. But wait a minute. Then that means they also got off the ark and I don't see any dinosaurs lurking around today. How do you explain that? Well, once again, that's a great question. And that brings us to the first question about dinosaurs getting off the ark, and that is what happened to dinosaurs when they got off the ark. I mean, again, last time I checked, I don't see any giant dinosaurs roaming all over the earth. Why is that if indeed they did get off the ark? Well, it's simple really when you look at it from a biblical perspective. When the dinosaurs got off the ark along with all the other kinds of animals, the world had totally changed from the one they left prior to the flood. As one person shared,
after the flood, the earth was a very different place. When Noah stepped off the ship, it must have felt like getting out on another planet. Nothing would have looked familiar. Most of the world was left covered with water.
7 out of every 10 spots of the globe are still underwater today.
All of the landmarks were destroyed.
The Garden of Eden was gone forever.
So was the whole land of Eden and every other land. Mud and rock were everywhere. Cold, forbidding mountains stood where none had been before.
And because of these drastic changes upon the earth after the flood, it naturally affected the dinosaurs and all of life when they got off the ark. Change of size, first of all, the pre-flood atmosphere that we saw in the previous study on a judged creation that induced giantism was no longer there. The increase of air pressure, the increase of oxygen, the lush environment, and the protection from the sun's harmful radiation was now gone. Thus, after the flood, the dinosaurs and all of life did not grow as large as they once used to prior to the flood. Slowly over time with each succeeding generation, their size would have decreased. Hence no giant dinosaurs roaming the earth today, not the size that we find in the fossil record anyway. Furthermore, not only their size would have been affected after the flood, but so would their numbers. Most likely, again due to the effects of a post-flood world, their population probably never reached the scale that it once used to be. And this is due to several possible factors. Change of stability, the worldwide flood catastrophe was only the beginning for the planet. Due to the effects of the worldwide flood, the world continued to have various kinds of catastrophes. Earthquakes and volcanoes still continued to plague animals and man, even after the flood was over and still do today on a smaller scale. Change of climate, temperatures had become extreme. Some parts of the world got much hotter after the flood. This eventually dried up all the water and left great deserts. In other places, snow began to fall for the first time because of freezing cold. A short ice age followed the flood in some parts of the world. Harmful radiation from the sun and space probably came down in much larger doses after the flood. The original world may have been protected from this radiation by a special atmosphere. The Earth's air may have contained a much higher amount of water, which kept the weather warmer and more pleasant. Before the flood, most likely the plants were watered by rivers, underground springs, and dew instead of by rain. Change of food. After the flood, many parts of the world became too harsh for the dinosaurs. No longer did the earth have the same great forests of huge, nutritious plants. It would have been hard for the dinosaurs to locate enough food. Change of life expectancy. It was not just the dinosaurs that died off. Great numbers of creatures have become extinct in the thousands of years since the flood. In the last 350 years alone, almost 400 species have disappeared. Today, some experts claim that one or more species of plants and animals may be lost every day. Most of the problem is caused by sinful and foolish human beings. Today, many animals are only being saved by zoos. Dinosaurs began to disappear long before people worried about such things. Extinction seems to be the rule in Earth history, not the formation of new types of animals as you would expect from evolution. Change of relationship. the flood and the changes it caused in the environment are the main reason dinosaurs died off. However, even for those that did survive, sinful people may have caused dinosaur deaths in an even more direct way. Man has often been responsible for killing the last animals of a kind. The mammoths and mastodons were wiped out by hunters. It could be that in the ancient time, people also killed dinosaurs for meat or because of the problems these animals caused. Maybe some killing was done just for sport. As one man shared,
after the flood, people began to kill the dinosaurs. The Bible says in Genesis chapter 9 that man was allowed to eat meat after the flood. The dinosaur would be a likely target. There would be a lot of hamburger in one dinosaur. You could feed the village for a while, right? And maybe they were also killed because they were a menace. Who wants to live next door to a Tyrannosaurus Rex? Or maybe even just to be a hero? Maybe you are a hunter? Do you ever go hunting for Bambi? If you were in your tree stand and a herd of deer came running right under you with only 3 bucks in the herd and you only had time to get off one shot, which one would you go for? The biggest one, right? There is just something about men. If you are going to shoot one, shoot the biggest one. I wonder how the hunter felt right after the flood, with dinosaurs available. I can see him now, shooting a Brachiosaurus, putting him on the back of a Jeep, and dragging him down to the taxidermist. He says, "Hey, mount this thing for me. I'm going to hang him on my wall." See, as the population of people began to grow, the population of bigger, ferocious animals began to diminish. Same thing happened here in West Florida. How many grizzly bears in West Florida? None. How many were here 500 years ago? Probably a bunch. When people move in, the bigger, ferocious animals were driven off or killed off. That's just the way it's always been. So as the population of the world grew after the flood, the population of the dinosaurs shrank. For the first 1,000 years or so after the flood, people were killing dinosaurs.
But you might be thinking, now wait a second here. Granted, that makes a whole lot of sense about the post-flood changes upon the world preventing us from having giant dinosaurs roaming the earth today after they got off the ark. But mankind was hunting them for many centuries after they got off the ark. Are you serious? Of course. And that brings us to the second question about dinosaurs getting off the ark, and that is, where did dinosaurs go when they got off the ark? You see, back then, they didn't call them dinosaurs when they hunted them, they called them dragons. Why? Well, first of all, again, the word dinosaur wasn't even invented until 1841 by Sir Richard Owen. So of course they wouldn't call them dinosaurs after the flood. The word wasn't even invented yet. But another word was dragon? And what's very interesting is that once you keep looking at the world and dinosaurs through biblical eyes, both before and after the flood, suddenly everything begins to make perfect sense, including what's mentioned in virtually every culture on the post-flood world. And that is the existence of dragons. You see, a set of evolutionary eyes automatically makes the assumption that any talk of dragons is purely mythological, even though they can't really explain why so many cultures talk about them. But the continued usage of biblical eyes reveals that dragons were not merely mythological creatures but actual creatures that we now call dinosaurs. This is where they went after they got off the ark. They were there the whole time, just called by a different name. Granted, not as large but real nonetheless. In fact, it wasn't that long ago that the word dragon was defined in the dictionary as very rare, though still living animal. Also, the World Book Encyclopedia carried this definition of dragons not that long ago.
The dragons of legend are strangely like actual creatures that have lived in the past. They are much like the great reptiles, which inhabited the earth long before man is supposed to have appeared on earth. Dragons were generally evil and destructive. Every country had them in its mythology.
However, thanks to the modern biased evolutionary goggles, the dictionary definition has now been changed to a mythical monster generally represented as a huge, winged reptile with crested head and enormous claws and teeth. So that's the question. Are dragons really mythical beings? Or are they biblical dinosaurs? Are they really fantasy? Or are they really a true part of our history? Is this where dinosaurs really went after getting off the ark? Well, let's take a look. The first proof that dragons are really dinosaurs is the biblical proof. Interestingly, the word dragon is used a number of times in the Old Testament. In most instances, the word dinosaur could substitute for dragon and it would fit very nicely. The Hebrew word commonly translated dragon in the KJV Hebrew, Tan, Tannen, Tannum, Tannoth, appears in the Old Testament some 30 times. There are passages in the Bible about dragons that lived on the land. He, Nebuchadnezzar, has swallowed me like a dragon, Jeremiah 51:34, the dragons of the wilderness, Malachi 1:3. Many biblical creationists believe that in many contexts these could refer to what we now call dinosaurs. Indeed, Strong's Concordance lists dinosaur as one of the meanings of Tannen/M. In Genesis 1:21, the Bible says, "And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed, after their kind." The Hebrew word here for sea monsters, whales in KJV, is the word translated elsewhere as dragon, Hebrew, Tannen. So, in the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, God may be describing the great sea dragons, sea-dwelling dinosaur-type animals, he created. There are other Bible passages about dragons that lived in the sea, the dragons in the waters, Psalm 74:13, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea, Isaiah 27:1. Though the word dinosaur strictly refers to animals that lived on the land, the sea reptiles and flying reptiles are often grouped with the dinosaurs. The sea dragons could have included dinosaur-type animals such as the Mosasaurus. The second proof that dragons are really dinosaurs is the comparison proof. Besides a skeptical view of the Bible and a presupposition of evolution, another big reason why people would scoff at the idea of dragons being dinosaurs is because of their preformed picture they have in their head about what a dragon was like. Thanks to the modern media and mass education, at the first mentioning of the word dragon, people think of a freaky four-legged reptilian creature that flew around breathing fire out of its mouth. And because of this, they laugh at the idea of this dragon being a dinosaur. But that's the misconception. That dragon is not the true dragon that's pictured for us in the historical records. Interestingly enough, they actually correspond quite well to the description of dinosaurs. Let's take a look.
Not all dragons were large, terrifying creatures, some were quite small. Not all dinosaurs were huge. Some, such as the Compsognathus, were smaller than cats.
The various stories of dragons show that they varied in size, as did the dinosaurs.
Not all dragons had wings or could fly. Many dragons were wingless creatures. Not all dinosaurs had wings, or could fly.
Only dinosaurs such as Pteranodon and Pterodactyls could fly. Though Pteranodon and Pterodactyls are pterosaurs, the term dinosaur can be used in a broad sense to describe these creatures.
Not all dragons emitted fire, as shown in today's paintings of them. The pictures we see of dragons are actually composite drawings. They are the result of taking features distinctive of different kinds of dinosaurs, and putting them all on one creature.
The same false picture of fish would be created, if one imagined the jaws of a piranha on the body of a flying fish.
Both are real animals. But thank God, no fish has both physical features. Not all dragons lived in caves. Some dragons are said to have lived in caves, while others live in the forest, or in the seas.
All of these are well-known habitations of dinosaurs. Also, stories also tell us that some dragons were lone hunters, while others lived in herds. It just happens to be a fact that some dinosaurs were also loners while others roamed in herds. Dragons are said to have laid eggs, and paleontologists have found numerous dinosaur eggs and egg nesting sites all over the world. Dragons do have a basis in reality.
Many cultures have passed down tales of these creatures, though some have been exaggerated through time. This is common with all oral traditions.
The Chinese even used ground-up dragon bones as medicine. When Americans examined the dragon bones, they realized they were actually the fossilized bones of dinosaurs. Dragons do look like dinosaurs. St. George is depicted as slaying a dragon in paintings from 250 to 300 AD, a dragon which looks like the dinosaur we know today as the Baryonyx. Also, recently a new species of dinosaur was discovered that looks just like what many of us think of when we think of dragons. The dinosaur is called Dracoryx hogwartsia. In 2004, a fascinating dinosaur skull was donated to the Children's Museum of Indianapolis by three Sioux City, Iowa, residents who found it during a trip to the Hell Creek Formation in South Dakota. The trio are still excavating the site, looking for more of the dinosaur's bones. Because of its dragon-like head, horns and teeth, the new species was dubbed Dracoryx hogwartsia. This name honors the Harry Potter fictional works, which features the Hogwarts school and recently popularized dragons. The dinosaur's skull mixes spiky horns, bumps and a long muzzle.
But unlike other members of the Pachycephalosaur family, which have domed foreheads, this one is flat-headed.
Consider some of the ancient stories of dragons, some fictional and some that might be authentic history of dinosaurs.
Gee, this is starting to remind me of the old saying, If it walks like a duck, acts like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. If dragons are walking like dinosaurs, acting like dinosaurs, and even looking like dinosaurs, gee, I'd say they're really dinosaurs. The third proof that dragons are really dinosaurs is the historical proof. Remember, after the flood, man was probably hunting dinosaurs after they got off the ark for food, or sport, or for protection. People were naturally afraid of them. And what's interesting is that's exactly what we find in the so-called dragon legends from around the world.
Ancient peoples all over the world have told of unusual, reptile-like creatures that once roamed the earth. There were many different types, both large and small. And there were many different names for them. The ancient people of Europe called them dragons. Many ancient descriptions of dragons sound similar to dinosaurs. The ancient, original dragon legends must have come from memories of dinosaurs. Scientists agree that legends are almost always based on facts, not just pure imagination. It cannot be an accident that so many separate peoples of the world tell such stories. Dragon legends and pictures can be found in Africa, India, Europe, the Middle East, the Orient, and every other part of the world. Dinosaur-like animals have been drawn, written about, and told about since the beginning of recorded history. Sometimes people in olden times made up scary or funny stories about these animals. This made the dragons and their hunters seem more special. Some of the stories really got wild and crazy. Many of the dragon legends are full of exaggeration, magic, and marvelous deeds. But this is not true of all of them. Many stories seem rather believable. Did some of these storytellers see live dinosaurs?
Gee, it's a great question. Maybe there's much more going on in the world of history than what evolution wants to admit, especially when it comes to dinosaurs. Shocker. Therefore, let's take a look at the historical proof from around the world, and you tell me if calling dragons dinosaurs is really that far-fetched. Dragons from England. England has its story of St. George, who slew a dragon that lived in a cave. It's one of the most famous accounts of a dragon slaying and is recorded for us in the story entitled, St. George and the Dragon, which was included in a collection of the lives of Catholic saints written about 1275. It states, at the town of Cyllene in Libya, there was a dragon, who was appeased by being fed 2 sheep a day. When these failed, the townsfolk offered by lot one of their young people. One day the lot fell on the king's daughter, who was led out to the sacrifice, dressed in her wedding gown. George appeared and transfixed the dragon with his spear and then using the princess's girdle led the bemused dragon into the town, where it was beheaded. The early Britons provide the first European accounts of reptilian monsters, one of which killed and devoured King Morvidus of Wales, circa 336 BC. Another monarch, King Peredur, however, managed to slay his monster at a place called Lynion, in Wales. Other well-known stories involving medieval heroes and dragons include Siegfried of the ancient Teutons, possibly the same person as Sigurd of Old Norse, who slew a monster named Fafnir. In London's British Museum, the ancient history book, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles records events that occurred nearly 1,000 years ago, including accounts of dragons that lived beside people. The fascinating thing is that the descriptions of these dragons fit the dinosaurs. A historical account of life in England describes a dragon people saw in AD 1405, close to the town of Bears, near Sudbury. There has lately appeared, to the great hurt of the countryside, a dragon, vast in body, with a crested head, teeth like a saw, and a tail extending to an enormous length. This description closely fits that of a Dilophosaurus or Creolophosaurus. Then the epic Anglo-Saxon poem Beowulf tells how Beowulf, circa AD 495-583, of Scandinavia killed a monster named Grendel, and its supposed mother, as well as several sea reptiles, but eventually lost his life at the age of 88 in the process of killing a flying reptile. The Saxon description of this creature fits that of a giant pteranodon. It was 50 feet in length, or possibly wingspan. The monster called Grendel, which Beowulf killed many years previously, is described as follows. He was apparently a youngster, having been known for only 12 years, man-like in stance, bipedal, and he had 2 small forelimbs that the Saxons call yorms, arms, one of which Beowulf tore off. He was a muthbona, one who slew with his mouth or jaws, and his skin was impervious to sword blows. Dragons from Ireland. There is the story of a 10th century Irishman who wrote of his encounter with what appears to have been a stegosaurus. The writer recorded an encounter with a large beast with iron on its tail, which pointed backwards. Its head was shaped a little like a horse's. And it had thick legs with strong claws. These details match features of dinosaurs like the Kentrosaurus and Stegosaurus. They had sharp pointed spines on their tails, thick legs, strong claws, and long skulls. Dragons from Thailand. In Thailand, there are pictures of boats with dragon heads on them. Throughout Thailand, there are legends that talk about dragon slayers. Dragons from Russia. A Russian medallion shows a man slaying a dragon. Dragons from Bulgaria. A Bulgarian postage stamp shows a man killing a dragon. Many national heroes in these ancient older countries are dragon slayers. Dragons from Babylon. One dragon story from the ancient land of Sumer in Babylon tells of the hero Gilgamesh. He decided to make a name for himself by traveling to a distant land to cut great cedar trees needed for his city. He reached the forest with 50 volunteers and discovered a huge reptile-like animal, which ate trees and reeds. The story simply says that Gilgamesh killed it and cut off its head for a trophy. Speaking of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had as his symbol the god Marduk on top of a fire-breathing dragon. When they found the original city of old Babylon, the ruins, they dug down into the sand and found perfectly preserved in the dry sand over there were the laws of the old city. The old city laws had hundreds and hundreds of pictures of dragons on them. How did they know about dragons in 600 BC? Well, there were some still around, that's how they knew about them. Dragons from Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great in 300 BC reported that his soldiers were scared by dragons when they conquered part of India. When he and his soldiers marched into India, they found that the Indians worshipped huge hissing reptiles that they kept in caves. The Indians considered them to be sacred, and worshipped them with great reverence. The Indians besought Alexander with many entreaties to leave the dragons alone, which he agreed to. However, when a dragon heard the noise made by the passing army, for it is an animal endowed with a very acute sense of hearing as well as of vision, it frightened and alarmed them all with a great hissing and blowing. It was said to be 70 cubits long, about 120 feet. It did not, however, show the whole of itself, but only exposed its head from the cave. Its eyes were said to have been of the size, and rotundity, of a Macedonian shield. Dragons from Apocrypha. According to the Catholic Bible, Daniel was said to kill a dragon. In their version of the Book of Daniel there are two extra chapters. Daniel 13 and 14. In Daniel 14 it tells the story of Daniel killing the dragon that the Babylonians worshipped by raking pitch, fat, and hair into lumps that the dragon consumed and then burst open. Here's the actual passage: the king had them put to death and handed Bel over to Daniel, who destroyed both the idol and its temple. There was a great dragon which the Babylonians worshipped too. The king said to Daniel, "Are you going to tell me that this is made of bronze? Look, it is alive, it eats and drinks, you cannot deny that this is a living God, worship it, then." Daniel replied, "I will worship the Lord my God, he is the living God. With your permission, your majesty, without using either sword or club, I shall kill this dragon." "You have my permission," said the king. Whereupon, Daniel took some pitch, some fat and some hair and boiled them up together, rolled the mixture into balls and fed them to the dragon. The dragon swallowed them and burst. Daniel said, "Now look at the sort of thing you worship." The Babylonians were furious when they heard about this and rose against the king. "The king has turned you," they said, "he has allowed Bel to be overthrown, and the dragon to be killed, and he has put the priest to death." Dragons from Rome. 200 years after the birth of Jesus Christ, a Roman mosaic shows two long-necked dragons fighting. What they are doing is not important. What they are is important. How could you have dinosaurs on a Roman mosaic from the 2nd century AD? They were not excavating dinosaur bones and piecing them together. How could they make such detailed images of these critters, unless they had seen them? Again, a creationist perspective makes perfect sense. A few dinosaurs were probably still in existence 1,800 years ago. They were probably smaller and more rare and generally in water. They would be the hardest ones to exterminate, the ones on land would be the easiest to kill off. From the evolutionary perspective, the story of dragons doesn't make very much sense. They all have to be mythology. A most interesting essay by one of the last of the Church Fathers, titled On Dragons and Ghosts, was very recently translated for the first time into Russian and published in Moscow. The author is John of Damascus, also known as Saint John Damascene. Like many ancient manuscripts, it refers to dragons, creatures which often resemble known dinosaur types or features, as real living creatures. Like most people who have been taught that dinosaurs died out millions of years before people appeared, Maxim Kozlov, the Russian Orthodox priest who produced the translation and commentary, does not accept that people actually encountered dragons/dinosaurs. Despite this, however, he praises the author of the essay for his soberness of mind in striking contrast to boundless mysticism and search for the mysterious. In fact, John of Damascus was an author of great intellect, a stranger to any gullibility or fable-telling. Moreover, the whole purpose of the essay is the exposure of various fables and superstitions. For instance, John wrote, "Some people claim that dragons can both take the human form and turn into serpents, sometimes small, sometimes huge, differing in body length and size. And sometimes having turned into people, they start to associate with them, appear to steal women and consort with them." To refute such ideas, he went on, "So we would ask, those who tell such stories, how many intelligent beings did God create? And if they do not know the answer, we will respond, two, I mean angels and humans, but if a dragon were to change its form becoming at one moment a serpent, at another a man, it clearly follows that dragons are intelligent beings greatly exceeding men, which has never been true, and never will be." John admonishes those who make such claims about dragons, namely that we should trust the teaching of Moses, and, more exactly, the Holy Spirit, having spoken through Moses. This teaching, reads, "And God brought them to Adam to see what he would call them, and whatever, Adam, called every living creature, that was its name," cf. Genesis 2:19. Hence, a dragon was one of the animals. John of Damascus goes on to say, "I am not telling you, after all, that there are no dragons. Dragons exist, but they are serpents, reptiles, born of other serpents. When just born and young, they are small, but when they grow up and mature, they become big and fat so that they exceed the other serpents in length and size. It is said they grow up more than 30 cubits, 14 meters, 45 feet. As for their thickness, they become as thick as a huge log." The Damascene patriarch appears to have been a reliable witness who, in addition, possessed much of the scientific knowledge of his time. A significant portion of his classical book, An Exact Exposition of the Orthodox Faith, is devoted to purely scientific data. The science of those times was descriptive by nature. It did not penetrate into the essence of things but generally recorded natural phenomena reasonably accurately. A report by such a well-educated scholar of that period should be carefully considered. The essay continues, Dio Cassius, the Roman, AD 155-236, who wrote the history of the Roman Empire and Republic, reports the following, one day, when Regulus, a Roman consul, 3rd C. BC, was fighting against Carthage, a dragon suddenly crept up and settled behind the wall of the Roman army. The Romans killed it by order of Regulus, skinned it and sent the hide to the Roman Senate. When the dragon's hide, as Dio says, was measured by order of the Senate, it happened to be, amazingly, 120 feet long, and the thickness was fitting to the length. John of Damascus is clearly describing the existence of real dragons, contrasting them with the fictional nonsense that was attributed to them. He writes further about another kind of dragon. These were given various mythical characteristics, such as the absence of a face. He says that in reality, this dragon is a type of beast, like the rest of the animals, for it has a goat-like beard, and a horn at the back of its head. Its eyes are large and gold-colored. These dragons can be either big or small. All serpent kinds are poisonous, except dragons, for they do not emit poison. Thus, the main purpose of the ancient author was to persuade his readers that dragons were real living creatures, and not mythical beings like ghosts, werewolves, faceless bogey creatures and so on. Dragons, he wrote, were absolutely real animals, though sometimes big and terrifying, which at that time were only rarely seen by humans. When we look at accounts of dragons in history, the similarity of many of them to various types of dinosaurs is apparent. Some dinosaurs are well known to have had bony protrusions and horns on their head, and some had spikes on their back and or tail, as is commonly seen in depictions of dragons. Since their soft tissue is not generally preserved as a fossil, we do not know what sort of protuberance under the jaw may have given rise to the common description of some dragons as having a beard. Some dinosaurs may have had a structure similar to that of the lizard known as the bearded dragon. Dragons from Scandinavia, Scandinavian countries had about as many tales of dragons as anywhere in the world. One old legend describes a reptile-like animal that had a body about the size of a large cow. Its two back legs were long and strong. But its front legs were remarkably short. And its jaws were quite large. One of the unique things about many dinosaurs was their short front legs, compared to their long, strong back legs. Many also had large jaws. Examples of dinosaurs which fit are the Edmontosaurus and the Iguanodon. In medieval times, the Scandinavians described swimming dragons and the Vikings placed dragons on the front of their ships to scare off the sea monsters. They called it the Kraken, the Great Dragon of the Sea. They built their ships to have dragon heads on them. One picture is from approximately 1000 AD. All the ancient North Scandinavian literature talks about dragons within the sea. They built their ships to look that way. In fact, Hans Egede, missionary to Greenland, drew a sketch of a sea monster he saw off the coast of Greenland in 1734. Numerous such stories have been recorded from the age of sailing ships, 1500 to 1900 AD, In various Nordic sagas, the slaying of dragons is depicted in some detail, and this helps us to reconstruct the physical appearance of some of these creatures. In the Volsunga saga, for example, the slaying of the monster Fafnir was accomplished by Sigurd digging a pit and waiting, inside the pit, for the monster to crawl overhead on its way to the water. This allowed Sigurd to attack the animal's soft underbelly. Clearly, Fafnir walked on all fours with his belly close to the ground. Likewise, the Völuspá tells us of a certain monster, which the early Vikings called a Nithhogr, his name, Corpstyr, revealing the fact that it lived off carrion. Dragons from Italy. In 1572, an Italian peasant killed a dragon that was bothering his cows. A scientist named Ulysses Aldrovandus carefully documented the whole encounter. He described a small dragon seen along a farm road in northern Italy. The date was May 13, 1572. The poor, rare creature was small enough that the farmer killed it just by knocking it on the head with his walking stick. The animal had done nothing wrong but hiss at the farmer's oxen as they approached it on the road. Ulysses obtained the dead body and made measurements and a drawing. He even had the animal mounted for a museum. It had a long neck, a very long tail, and a fat body. Think about that. In 1572, you could have gone to a museum in Italy to visit a dinosaur on display. Not the bones, the skin stuffed and mounted by a taxidermist. Wait a minute. A dinosaur was on display in an Italian museum only 400 years ago. Again, from a creationist perspective, that makes sense. It was apparently a small Tanistrophius dinosaur. Dragons from France. A city in France was renamed Nerluc because of a man named Nerluc who slew the dragon that was bothering the city. In fact, it's still called Nerluc today. The animal was bigger than an ox and had long, sharp, pointed horns on its head. As we know, there were a number of different horned dinosaurs. The Triceratops is one example. Was this a surviving Triceratops? Dragons from science books. The great Swiss naturalist and medical doctor Conrad Gessner published a well-known old four-volume encyclopedia from 1516 to 1565 entitled Historiae Animalium. In it he shares that dragons were not extinct in the 1500s but still alive. However, the animals were said to be extremely rare and relatively small by then. The familiar story of Beowulf and the legend of St. George slaying a dragon, which are well known in the annals of English literature, likely have some basis in fact. Dragons were even described in reputable zoological treatises published during the Middle Ages. In medieval times, scientifically minded authors produced volumes called bestiaries, a compilation of known, and sometimes imaginary, animals accompanied by a moralizing explanation and fascinating pictures. One such volume is the Aberdeen Bestiary, written in the early 1500s and preserved in the library of Henry VIII. Along with the newt, the salamander, and various kinds of snakes is the description and depiction of the dragon. The dragon is bigger than all other snakes or all other living things on earth. For this reason, the Greeks call it Drakon, from this is derived its Latin name Draco. The dragon, it is said, is often drawn forth from caves into the open air, causing the air to become turbulent. The dragon has a crest, a small mouth, and narrow blowholes through which it breathes and puts forth its tongue. Its strength lies not in its teeth but in its tail, and it kills with a blow rather than a bite. It is free from poison. They say that it does not need poison to kill things, because it kills anything around which it wraps its tail. From the dragon, not even the elephant, with its huge size, is safe. For lurking on paths along which elephants are accustomed to pass, the dragon knots its tail around their legs and kills them by suffocation. Dragons are born in Ethiopia and India, where it is hot all year round. Dragons from China. The Chinese have lots of stories of their emperors using dragons to pull their chariots on special occasions. In fact, many Chinese recipes call for dragon saliva, bone, or teeth ground up for special medicines. Could it be that they were really killing off dinosaurs? It makes perfect sense to me. China is also renowned for its dragon stories, and dragons are prominent on Chinese pottery, embroidery, and carvings. Some ornamental pictures of dragons are shaped remarkably like dinosaurs. Evolutionists have brought forward some bizarre theories for how such realistic depictions could have been made. Furthermore, records of Marco Polo in China show that the royal house kept dragons for ceremonies. Marco Polo reported in 1271 that on special occasions the royal chariot was pulled by dragons, and in 1611 the emperor appointed the post of a royal dragon feeder. In other cultures, it was a great honor to kill these beasts. There are numerous records of warriors killing great beasts in order to establish credibility in a village. Thousands of dragon stories and pictures can be found in ancient Chinese books and art. One interesting legend tells about a famous Chinese man named Yu. After the Great World Flood, Yu surveyed the land of China and divided it into sections. He built channels to drain the water off to the sea and helped make the land livable again. Many snakes and dragons were driven off from the marshlands when you created the new farmlands. Some old Chinese books even tell of a family that kept dragons to use their blood for medicines and highly prizing their eggs, and even raise the babies. Ancient Chinese books even tell of people using dragons' blood, fat, brains, and saliva for medicine. The Chinese calendar shows 12 animals in which 11 are known and real, the rat and the chicken, etc. The other one, the dragon, is supposedly a myth, or is it? Maybe they're all real. It doesn't seem logical that the ancient Chinese, when constructing their zodiac, would include one mythical animal with 11 real animals. Dragons from Africa. The respected Greek explorer Herodotus described small flying reptiles in ancient Egypt and Arabia. These animals sound amazingly like the small Rhamphorhynchus. They have the same snake-like body and bat-like wings. Many had been killed near the city of Buda of Arabia. He was shown a canyon with many piles of their backbones and ribs. Herodotus wrote, "There is a place in Arabia, situated very near the city of Buda, to which I went, on hearing of some winged serpents, and when I arrived there, I saw bones and spines of serpents, in such quantities as it would be impossible to describe. The form of the serpent is like that of the water snake, but he has wings without feathers, and as like as possible to the wings of a bat." Herodotus said that these animals could sometimes be found in the spice groves. They were small in size and of various colors. Large numbers would sometimes gather in the frankincense trees. When workers wanted to gather the tree's valuable juices, they would use smelly smoke to drive the flying reptiles away. The well-respected Greek, Aristotle, said that in his time it was common knowledge that creatures like this also existed in Ethiopia. Similar animals, 3 feet long, were also described in India by the geographer Strabo. Microsoft Encarta Encyclopedia, Dinosaur Entry, explains that the historical references to dinosaur bones may extend as far back as the 5th century BC. In fact, some scholars think that the Greek historian Herodotus was referring to fossilized dinosaur skeletons and eggs when he described griffins guarding nests in Central Asia. Ancient explorers and historians, like Josephus, told of small flying reptiles in ancient Egypt and Arabia and described their predators, the ibis, stopping their invasion into Egypt. John Gordzon noted the Egyptian representation of tail vanes with flying reptiles and concluded that they must have observed pterosaurs or they would not have known to sketch this leaf-shaped tail. He also matched a flying reptile, observed in Egypt and sketched by the outstanding Renaissance scientist Pierre Boulogne, with the Dimorphodon genus of pterosaur. Dragons from Europe, dinosaurs in the form of flying reptiles, were a feature of Welsh life until surprisingly recent times. As late as the beginning of the last century, elderly folk at Penlyn in Glamorgan used to tell of a colony of winged serpents that lived in the woods around Penlyn Castle. As Marie Trevelyan tells us, the woods around Penlyn Castle, Glamorgan, had the reputation of being frequented by winged serpents, and these were the terror of old and young alike. An aged inhabitant of Penlyn, who died a few years ago, said that in his boyhood the winged serpents were described as very beautiful. They were coiled when in repose, and looked as if they were covered with jewels of all sorts. Some of them had crests sparkling with all the colors of the rainbow. When disturbed they glided swiftly, sparkling all over, to their hiding places. When angry, they flew over people's heads, with outspread wings, bright and sometimes with eyes too, like the feathers in a peacock's tail. He said it was no old story invented to frighten children, but a real fact. His father and uncle had killed some of them, for they were as bad as foxes for poultry. The old man attributed the extinction of the winged serpents to the fact that they were terrors in the farmyards and covers. This account is intriguing in many respects, not the least being the fact that it is not a typical account of dragons. The creatures concerned were not solitary and monstrous beasts, but small creatures that lived in colonies. Not at all like the larger species of winged reptile that used to nest upon an ancient burial mound, or tumulus, at Trelech Arbetus in the county of Dyfed, for example. But whilst we are in Wales, it is worth noting that at Llanbardon y Gerrig, the church contains a carving of a local giant reptile whose features include large paddle-like flippers, a long neck and a small head. Glaslyn, in Snowdon, is a lake wherein a fank or lake monster was sighted as recently as the 1930s. On this occasion two climbers on the side of a mountain looked down onto the surface of Glaslyn and they saw the creature, which they described as having a long grey body, rise from the depths of the lake to the surface, raise its head and then submerge again. One could multiply such reports by the hundred. In England and Scotland, again until comparatively recent times, other reptilian monsters were sighted and spoken of in many places. There are nearly 200 locations in Britain alone which dinosaur activity has been reported. For instance, a giant reptile at Bears in Suffolk, is known to us from a chronicle of 1405, close to the town of Bears, near Sudbury, there has lately appeared, to the great hurt of the countryside, a dragon, vast in body, with a crested head, teeth like a saw, and a tail extending to an enormous length. Having slaughtered the shepherd of a flock, it devoured many sheep. After an unsuccessful attempt by local archers to kill the beast, due to its impenetrable hide, in order to destroy him, all the country people around were summoned. But when the dragon saw that he was again to be assailed with arrows, he fled into a marsh or mere and there hid himself among the long reeds, and was no more seen. Later in the 15th century, according to a contemporary chronicle that still survives in Canterbury Cathedral's library, the following incident was reported. On the afternoon of Friday 26th of September, 1449, two giant reptiles were seen fighting on the banks of the River Stour, near the village of Little Cornard, which marked the English county borders of Suffolk and Essex. One was black, and the other reddish and spotted. After an hour-long struggle that took place to the admiration of many of the locals, beholding them, the black monster yielded and returned to its lair, the scene of the conflict being known ever since as Sharpfight Meadow. As late as August, 1614, the following sober account was given of a strange reptile that was encountered in St. Leonard's Forest in Sussex. The sighting was near a village that was known as Dragon's Green long before this report was published. This serpent, or dragon as some call it, is reputed to be 9 feet, or rather more, in length, and shaped almost in the form of an axle of a cart, a quantity of thickness in the middest, and somewhat smaller at both ends. The former part, which he shoots forth as a neck, is supposed to be an L, 3 feet 9 inches or 1 L 4 cms, long, with a white ring, as it were, of scales about it. The scales along his back seem to be blackish, and so much as is discovered under his belly, appeareth to be red. It is likewise discovered to have large feet, but the eye may there be deceived, for some suppose that serpents have no feet. The dragon rids away, as we call it, as fast as a man can run. His food, rabbits, is thought to be, for the most part, in a canny warren, which he much frequents. There are likewise upon either side of him discovered two great bunches so big as a large football, and, as some think he, will in time grow to wings, but God, I hope, will, to defend the poor people in the neighborhood, that he shall be destroyed before he grows to fledge. This dragon was seen in various places within a circuit of 3 or 4 miles, and the pamphlet names some of the still living witnesses who had seen him. These included John Steele, Christopher Holder, and a certain widow woman dwelling near Faygate. Another witness was the carrier of Horsham, who lieth at the White Horse, in Southwark. One of the locals set his two mastiffs onto the monster, and apart from losing his dogs he was fortunate to escape alive from the encounter, for the dragon was already credited with the deaths of a man and woman. When approached unwittingly, our pamphleteer tells us, the monster was of countenance very proud and at the sight or hearing of man or cattle will raise his neck upright and seem to listen and loca about with great arrogancy. An eyewitness account of typically reptilian behavior. In 1867 was seen, for the last time, the monster that lived in the woods around Fittleworth in Sussex. It would run up to people hissing and spitting if they happened to stumble across it unawares, although it never harmed anyone. Several such cases could be cited, but suffice it to say that too many incidents like these are reported down through the centuries and from all sorts of locations for us to say that they are all fairy tales. For example, Scotland's famous Loch Ness Monster is too often thought to be a recent product of the local tourist board's efforts to bring in some trade, yet Loch Ness is by no means the only Scottish loch where monsters have been reported. Loch Lomond, Loch Awe, Loch Rannoch and the privately owned Loch Moher, over 1,000 feet deep, also have records of monster activity in recent years. Indeed, there have been over 40 sightings at Loch Moher alone since the end of the last war, and over 1,000 from Loch Ness in the same period. However, as far as Loch Ness itself is concerned, few realize that monstrous reptiles, no doubt the same species, have been sighted in and around the loch since the so-called Dark Ages, the most notable instance being that which is described in Adhavnan's famous 6th-century Life of St. Columba. On hearing this, and with never a thought for his own safety, the brave saint immediately ordered one of his followers to jump into the freezing water to see if the monster was still in the vicinity. Adhavnan relates how the thrashing about of the alarmed and unhappy swimmer, Lun McCumin by name, attracted the monster's attention. Suddenly, on breaking the surface, the monster was seen to speed towards the luckless chap with its mouth wide open and screaming like a banshee. Columba, however, refused to panic, and from the safety of the dry land rebuked the beast. Whether the swimmer added any rebukes of his own is not recorded, but the monster was seen to turn away, having approached the swimmer so closely that not the length of a punt pole lay between them. Columba, naturally, claimed the credit for the swimmer's survival, although the reluctance of the monster to actually harm the man is the most notable thing in this incident. The first swimmer had been savaged and killed, though not eaten, and the second swimmer was likewise treated to a display of the creature's wrath, though not fatally. Most likely, The two men had unwittingly entered the water close to where the creature kept her young, and she was reacting in a way that is typical of most species. Gorillas, bull elephants, ostriches, indeed all sorts of creature will charge at a man, hissing, screaming and trumpeting alarmingly, yet will rarely kill him or harm him so long as the man takes the hint and goes away. We can rely on it that Columba's follower, utterly lacking his saintly master's fortitude, had begun the process of taking the hint in plenty of time for the monster to realize that killing him would not be necessary. Yet not even Loon McCumin's expense is that uncommon. As recently as the 18th century, in a lake called Lyn Y Gator in Snowdon, Wales, a certain man went swimming. He reached the middle of the lake and was returning to the shore when his friends who were watching him noticed that he was being followed by ... a long, trailing object winding slowly behind him. They were afraid to raise an alarm, but went forward to meet him as soon as he reached the shore where they stood. Just as he was approaching, the trailing object raised its head, and before anyone could render aid, the man was enveloped in the coils of the monster. It seems that the man's body was never recovered. Wow! It's not only unfortunate that that man's body was never recovered, but at the present rate of the blindness of evolutionary goggles, it makes you wonder if the true history of dinosaurs will ever be recovered, by society that is. It's all been sitting there right under our noses in the Bible all along, as well as this historical evidence. In fact, the more one examines the evidence in light of biblical eyes, one thing is for sure, evolution is the fairy tale, not the dragons like this person shares.
Stories of dragons have been handed down for generations in many civilizations.
No doubt many of these stories have been exaggerated through the years. But that does not mean they had no original basis in fact.
Even some living lizards look like dragons, and it is easy to see how a larger variety of such an animal could frighten a community. Have you ever seen an old dinosaur film where they used an iguana in a miniature town set to create the illusion of a great dragon? Also, there are many very old history books in various libraries around the world that have detailed records of dragons and their encounters with people. Surprisingly, or not so surprisingly for creationists, many of these descriptions of dragons fit with how modern scientists would describe dinosaurs, even Tyrannosaurus. Unfortunately, this evidence is not considered valid by evolutionists. Why? Only because their belief is that man and dinosaurs did not live at the same time. However, the more we research the historical literature, the more we realize there is overwhelming evidence that dragons were real beasts, much like our modern reconstructions of dinosaurs, and that their existence has been recorded by many different people, even just hundreds of years ago. Why do we today think we are so much smarter than those in the past who saw the creatures firsthand before many of them became extinct?
The disillusionment of men in the present failed to disqualify man's testimony of the past. Why are we so arrogant as to dogmatically say that man has never seen a living dinosaur, despite all the historical and physical evidence to the contrary? To dismiss dragons as fictitious is a sad attempt to rewrite history.
The obvious conclusion is that except for their devotion to evolutionary theory, identification of dinosaurs with dragons would be the logical interpretation of the evidence.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but if people would just take off those biased cracked evolutionary goggles and put on the biblical ones when looking at the world and its history, I'd say everything makes perfect sense, including the mentioning of dragons. How about you? Why, if I didn't know better, I'd say dinosaurs really did get both on and off the ark, just like the Bible says they did. Gee, why am I not surprised? And so here's the point. I'd say it's not only pretty clear that dinosaurs got on and off the ark, but I'd also say somebody's doing a masterful job of trying to cover the whole thing up, you know what I'm saying? And gee whiz, I wonder why? Could it be that people would not only find out that dinosaurs came from the actual hand of God, but they would see they were also used to teach us to have a healthy fear of God, so we would get right with Him before it was too late? You know folks, if I didn't know better, I'd say somebody's trying to keep people from the truth, you know what I'm saying? Gee, I wonder who that might be? People please, don't miss the real purpose of dinosaurs. They weren't just big and fearful and came from the hand of God, they exist to teach us to have a healthy fear of God. Why? Because one day people, you're going to stand before God and you're going to be judged by God, and He alone has the power to take you to heaven or throw you straight into hell. Hello? That's something to be fearful of. But that's right, if you don't want to take my word for it, then please, I beg you, listen to God's.
Jonah 1:15-16. Then they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to Him.
O people, I beg you, Please don't be like Jonah or even the pagans around him. Don't wait until God brings judgment upon you or someone else before you fear him. Do it now while you're receiving mercy from him. And so I ask you, what's it going to take for you to stop being arrogant towards God and instead humble yourself before God and get saved through Jesus Christ, before it's too late? As you saw in this study, God is being gracious to us. He's given us the clear evidence that dinosaurs did get on and off the ark to show us that we can not only trust the word of God, but that we need to have a healthy fear of God. Why? Because one day people, when you least expect it, your life is going to be over. It's just one heartbeat away. And when that happens, you're going to be standing before Almighty God. And the Bible is clear. If on earth you had repented of your sins and asked Jesus Christ to forgive you, then you will go straight into heaven. But if you did not repent of your sins and you arrogantly mocked him, you will go straight into hell. And so I beg you, please, please, won't you turn from your wicked ways? Won't you get right with God? Won't you escape the eternal judgment to come? People, please, this is not a game. All eternity is on the line and time is running out. Your death is going to be here before you know it, but by then it'll be too late. Please, cry out to God now. Humble yourself and ask Jesus to forgive you of your sins before it's too late.